Thank you for joining in on another Mold Talks. Today, I have a very special guest. His name is Brendan. And Brendan, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and let everyone know why you're here?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Michael. I'm happy to be here. I really enjoyed our Instagram Live that we did a few weeks back. So I'm super excited for another kind of moldy conversation with a fellow mold bro. So my whole journey with mold, it's kind of crazy because a lot of people do consider me to be one of the leading experts on mold and mold illness using a functional medicine approach, which I'm still trying to figure out. Like, well, how did that ever happen? How did a guy with a fitness and nutrition background get to the point where mold has become a huge, huge part of my career path and business model? So, you know, I started my career back when I was 18 as a personal trainer and nutrition coach. I was very passionate about health, fitness, performance, optimizing metabolic health, using movement as medicine, food as medicine primarily. But during that time, I was actually really struggling with my own mental health. And at the age of 21, I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder and ADHD. I actually even went through an intentional overdose, almost cost me my life. I woke up in the ICU. There was this whole crazy episode. And the thing is, that actually was the beginning of a much worse phase of my life, where then I was actually in a relationship. I was engaged to a woman who had 3 children, and we were living in a water damaged home. And I knew nothing. I knew nothing about mold illness. I knew nothing about some of these more technical functional medicine subjects. But she, my ex-fiance, she was the canary in the coal mine, you know. So she was the one that came down with the mysterious, debilitating, you know, she's like the definition of SIRS. And I know that, you know, your audience, my audience, they're familiar with that terminology of the chronic inflammatory response syndrome, the biotoxin illness. So she was the one that, you know, bedridden, fibromyalgia, peripheral neuropathy, musculoskeletal pain and vibrating sensations, mold brain, a lot of cognitive dissonance and very volatile personality changes. She got really emaciated, which we see sometimes where sometimes they get like really puffy and they pack on weight and they have a hard time losing weight, or it's the other way around. They get really emaciated. People were saying like, oh, is she anorexic? Like, what's wrong with her? And nobody could figure it out. Like, we went straight to our medical doctor, no help there, physical therapy, chiropractor. We tried to meet with a naturopathic physician, but we couldn't afford the out-of-pocket nature, which sure. So many people. So, I mean, we really, like, we went through hell. And I want to be very honest and transparent. I still, to this day, do not know if it was mold illness, because it actually wasn't until 2 to 3 years after the relationship ended and we went our separate ways that, you know, I dove in it. Trying to save her is what got me into functional medicine, but it wasn't even until a few years later I got exposed to the concept of mold illness. And then when I did, I latched onto it because I was like, that's exactly what, you know, resonates. That has to be it. But I never did get the opportunity to confirm, because she and I went our separate ways. And unfortunately, she chose to take her life in August of 2020. So she's not even here anymore. But, you know, so that whole thing runs deep with me. And, you know, there was never any real closure. But I do believe that mold was a contributing factor based on the water damage to the home. And anyway, so since then, nearly all of the clients I've been working with privately for the past 5 years have been mold cases. So whether she had mold or not, I'll never know, but it's definitely become a huge area of focus and expertise. And, you know, when it comes to root causes of mental health issues, it doesn't get worse than mold. So I'm very glad and grateful for people like you and our fellow Mold Squad friends that, you know, we're trying to raise some awareness around this.
Yeah, and, you know, I certainly know you don't have the clinical data, because unfortunately you didn't have the knowledge and the testing capabilities, both on the environmental and the clinical side. But I would agree with your suspicion based upon your experience and what you now know. Yeah. And it's a sad story, right? Of, you know, obviously this person took their life, which is the ultimate sacrifice here, and what having to go through what you go through. This impacts not only the physiological stuff, but as well as, you know, mentally, right? And it weighs heavily on people. And unfortunately, you know, I've heard of several cases, you know, in this regard, and it's very disheartening to hear. You know, and I know that this is something that someone that was very close to you. And I know that it probably comes with a lot of pain for you to experience as well. And gave you the passion, you know, to go on and help other people so they never get to that point. So I appreciate all that you do too. How did it impact you? You know, because most people, most men either aren't aware that mold is impacting them or they think it's not, right? And so, mm-hmm. You typically get women who are more intuitive of what's going on that, you know, have these correlations that they start to connect to, and then they go down this path of testing to validate it. But most men do not, right? They don't believe in it and stuff like that. So yeah, how did it impact you? Because it sounds like it was differently than what she was going through, as you mentioned, the canary in the coal mine reference, which mm-hmm. we can talk about, but you know, how did it impact you, and do you think it had a contribution to your mental health?
Yeah, I do. It's kind of hard to say because there's a lot of confounding factors there. I really like what you said as far as like women are generally a little bit more in tune with their body, and they're also more bought into health information of any kind, right? You know, it's middle-aged women that are the greatest consumers of any kind of health, holistic health, functional medicine. Whereas like men tend to, unfortunately, and I think there's an issue with that where a lot of men are very, like, no, I'm fine. And it's like, yeah. Well, your blood work does not say that you're fine, but I appreciate how you're trying to really shove it down to be all masculine and strong, AKA emotionally repressed and, you know, in denial in a lot of ways. But I was already kind of really struggling with a lot of things. I was really burnt out in general, but during that time, cause the, you know, our relationship was toxic. I'll just say it. Sure. Like the relationship itself was toxic. The environment was probably toxic. The, you know, her exes that hung around like energy vampires. So there are a lot of things that I think were pulling both of us down, a lot of stress, a lot of other variables. But I will say during that time, I mean, my fatigue and my depression, I wouldn't really say brain fog, but the depression and the fatigue were what I was experiencing. And then she had three kids and they were all living in the same house with us, where the two daughters, nothing really notable with them. The son, sinusitis, allergy, brain fog, ADHD type of stuff. So, you know, it's very plausible. Like we know for a fact that home is, you know, old, musty, water damaged. But even while we were living there, the bathtub flooded and it was dripping down into the garage, and we just did an amateur like fans and mop it up and move on with life. So, and that's the thing, you know, obviously with mold, it's such a tricky subject where it's like we want to present the information to bring awareness and validity, but we also have to play the other side of that coin, which is like, well, everybody's exposed to mold every day, so it's kind of a matter of how great is the exposure and how great is the metabolic immunological resilience, right? So you get the people that have not a lot of metabolic or immunological resilience, whether it's genetic or epigenetic in origin, and then greater exposure, like that's an equation for some kind of mold illness to start brewing. Sure. So it's a complicated thing to, you know, even qualify.
Well, it's like in layman's terms, a lot of people talk about these toxic buckets, right? Like everybody has their own size bucket and they can only withstand so much. And with water damaged buildings, we have mold, we have bacteria, we have actinomycetes. There's a whole slew of things that can ensue, the toxins created by both. So for a lot of people, you know, this exposure definitely topples them over, and sets the stage for illness and chronic illness to take form. So I think that, it's really important to always look at both sides of the coin, of course, right? Because we want to be careful with the information that we give people. But I think the reality of the situation is, you know, when you have these situations in your home and you let them fester, they're going to become bigger and bigger problems. And they can create a potential impact on your health. So having a clean environment is always, you know, something that you want to do, because especially the way we build our homes in modern buildings, we kind of are trapped in these buildings that don't ventilate well. The air exchange is getting less and less with the new styles of construction going towards net zero energy efficiency. So we're having these additional challenges that we've never had before, on top of everything else, kind of our health declining as a society and making us more susceptible to environmentally acquired illness with everything else that goes into our body. It really, you know, creates big, big health challenges. And so it's sad to see, you know, that you guys went through all of this stuff. And, you know, it's obviously, it sounds like you guys had other factors at play, but I'm sure this didn't help, right?
No. Yeah. And I think that was really well said, because like we have to apply context so that people can, you know, sort of qualify for themselves, like, does it seem like maybe this, you know, could be relevant for me? And I swear, like, my quarter one business launch is all mold stuff. I'm teaching a mold workshop next weekend, and then a 10-hour mold seminar a couple weeks after that. So I've been, you know, very deep back in all of my mold content, refurbishing it. So like, I was just looking at one of the research papers I'm citing in my presentation. You know, it was talking about how it's estimated, and this is one research paper, just one, but still it was saying, you know, it's estimated that up to 50% of illnesses are caused by low air quality indoors, right? And like, my biggest passions, you know, because big pharma, they're over there doing big pharma stuff. And obviously people are starting to wake up around kind of the corruption around that and issues around that. But I'm really passionate about the environmental and lifestyle side of illness, right? Because we have control over that. We have control over our lifestyle, and we have control over the environments that we put ourselves in, right? And if we put ourselves in the right environment and we're behaving, aka the lifestyle component, in a healthy way within that healthy environment, you know, you won't become that slave consumer of big pharma. So I think we need a lot more awareness, because like you're saying, I mean, what, like humans, like we evolved for hundreds of thousands of years out in the natural environment, immersed into the microbiota of the natural world. And like you're saying, now we are sealing ourselves off in these, you know, like pseudo caves with all the formaldehydes and chemicals and VOCs. Yep. And this is a perfect petri dish, you know, for mold and bacteria. Yep. And stuff to grow, and the poor ventilation. So, you know, I think so much of today's chronic illnesses and kind of the chronic disease pandemic or epidemic, whatever you want to call it, it's so much driven by environment and lifestyle, right? So, and one thing I do want to comment before I shut up on the ramble, but so many of us will always say, like, you can't heal in the environment that made you sick. But I actually, it's not entirely true either. I literally just had a case study, one of my clients this week, who, you know, we just did her ERMI test and it was god awful. We've been working with her for over a year, and it's like, she actually is healing. She is getting better while living in a compromised environment, because it's like, well, we're improving the lifestyle. We're improving the metabolic, physiological, immunological resilience, even though the environment hasn't changed. Now, I don't think she's going to heal fully, you know, like we're kind of, we're a little bit stuck, but it's such a balance of,
well,
like,
no, it's good to know that people can take steps towards that, right? Regardless of their environment. Cause there are many people who live in apartments. Maybe they can't move right away. Maybe they're in a home and they don't have the resources to remediate. Maybe it's something that they have to save up for. So it's great to hear that, you know, you're working with people and you're seeing some success, and, you know, at least you're buying them time to do what they need to do to help change their environment. But that's really awesome news. And I'm glad to hear that, you know, and I think that that's useful information for people to know, and they should definitely reach out to you about that. Why don't you explain a little bit about this metabolic resilience and, you know, kind of what your program is designed to do for people to achieve that, tying it in with a lot of the lifestyle choices that you're going to ask them to make, right? I mean, all of this stuff is important. And obviously, as you said earlier, you can control these things, right? And so you always want to be the command in chief to what you can control, because if you worry about all the things you can't control, you know, you never get ahead.
Yeah. Whoa. I mean, that was a profound statement you just made, because I get that all the time. I get tons of inquiries every week. And honestly, most of the inquiries, like, they are not work-withable. Like, they're not in a place psycho-emotionally where we can help them, because they're too lost within themselves. They're too far down the rabbit hole of fear and details. I can't tell you how many inquiries I get every week where people are literally freaking out, like, help me, help me, help me. I have the dreaded HLA and I think I have mold in my environment. And it's like, I can't work with somebody behaving that way, sort of thing. And that's a good example, right? Like, everybody wants to squawk about, I have the HLA, the dreaded HLA, therefore I am incapable of detoxing mold. And it's like, you have drank too much of that Kool-Aid and it's preventing you from being able to take rational steps towards a better situation, right? Because it's all this, like you said, I always think of the, how much toxic burden, what's the inflammatory load, right? Because like when we're really talking about what drives illness, physiologically, it's oxidative stress driven by, you know, toxicity and mitochondrial dysfunction, all these things. But it's, you know, toxicity and oxidative stress and inflammation. Like those are the mechanisms that drive right. illness, period. And so obviously as the toxin exposure goes up and up and up, which, yeah, the more mold and bacteria and whatever else is in your environment goes up and up and up, that's a lot for your detox system to have to handle. But then when you look at, it's like, okay, well, research shows 88% of Americans are metabolically ill, 70% are overweight or obese, 43% are diabetic, 24% have a fatty liver. That's metabolic illness. Like, what's the big takeaway from COVID? Like, oh, metabolic illness increases susceptibility to infectious disease. It increases susceptibility to any kind of disease. Like, you're unhealthy. We could call it metabolic illness. We could just say you're unhealthy, like whatever it is. So, you know, when we talk about, you know, resilience, it's like that can be kind of further categorized of psychological resilience. Like you're just a really mentally strong, tough person. Metabolic, as in your metabolism is healthy. It's resilient, you know, the mold. So I just moved into this apartment last October. And the reason why was I found mold. I have a picture of it. Mold was growing out from my ventilation system. It was deep in the airways. That's about as bad as it can get, right? Because anytime the air kicks on, it's blowing fungal fragments and spores and mycotoxins everywhere. And I talked to the dude that dug into it and did an amateur apartment remediation job, bleached it, painted, you know, that was what they did. And it was deep in there. And it's like, how long has that been in there? Months, years? I don't know. So my exposure was elevated for a while, but did I get sick from it? No. Why? Well, you just have good genes, Brennan. Well, I also live an impeccably healthy lifestyle. You know, my diet, my exercise, my sleep hygiene, my stress management, my supplementation. So it's about, if you nurture the body effectively, it improves your immunity, your metabolic resilience, however you want to define it. And that's what we need. Like that's the message that I wish America and mainstream media has been communicating for the past 2 years, is like, instead of incentivizing stuff with Krispy Kreme and cheeseburgers, like how about we, you know, leave the gyms open and shut down fast food? Or how about we encourage people to build up their immunity and immune resilience a little bit more naturally? It applies to mold and everything else.
So I love what you're saying here. And I think we're going to call this episode Ripping the Band-Aid Off, because I think it really ties into, you know, the way in which you approach a situation, right? And you have, in order for you to work with somebody and be successful, they have to be willing to confront all of these things, right? And I think that's the simplicity of it. If you can't confront, you know, lifestyle changes, if you can't confront the science behind what you're doing medically and clinically, you know, they're not going to be able to heal, right? And they're always, and you know, a lot of people do get caught down these rabbit holes of, you know, all these different things. I would love for you to touch on the HLA-DR gene, but I think the point that you're making here, which is a very valid point, is you know, in order to change, you can't do the same thing over and over again. You right. have to be willing to be open to new ideas. And a lot of them are going to be challenging and mm-hmm. they're going to be hard. This illness is hard emotionally, you know, mentally, physically, financially. It's a big burden. Mm-hmm. And you have to be open to change for it to work successfully. And I think, you know, you make a very good point. And I think that, you know, ripping the Band-Aid off is what you need to do. And you need to, it's probably not for the faint of heart, you know, to have mm-hmm. to confront a lot of these things, but nonetheless, it's very important.
Yeah. I mean, the struggle for survival is never for the faint of heart. Right. And I think we've lost that. I think because of the modern unconscious consumerism lifestyle, that is just the modern way of living, everything's pretty cushy, right? Everything's really convenient. You're protected, you're sheltered. We don't have the same struggle for survival that every other generation of human that has ever existed did. You know, life was a lot harder for humans 100 years ago, two, five, just it keeps getting harder the further back in time you go. These days, it can be pretty cush, right? We have maybe more psychological stress than ever because our brains are wired to look for some sort of perceived threat. So we make up imaginary threats that are not real struggles for survival. And I'm not saying any of this to like invalidate people's struggles. We all have our struggles. The question is like, are you going to find the fortitude and the grit to do what it takes to overcome that, right? And unfortunately, what I see so much of, especially in the mold, Lyme, chronic illness space, I think there's too many practitioners, and I don't know if they know that they're doing it or not, but I think there's too many providers that are kind of enabling this inconducive ideology of like, nope, if you just take the right binder for the right mycotoxin, and if we do the genetics and we put you on that fancy silver bullet protocol, and it's like, it doesn't work that way, right? Like the biggest thing that I find over and over, and I try to really speak out about this a lot, is a lot of these people sick with mold or Lyme or whatever it is, it's not because they're, you know, not doing the right pharmaceutical or they're not taking the right supplement protocol. It's the foundation of their metabolic health is compromised, their psychological resilience. And I think there's so much coaching around that that has to happen. And so my heart really hurts for these people that they're very lost down the rabbit hole. They're very confused. They're bleeding out money because each functional doctor is like, no, I'll be able to figure it out. I can figure out your root cause. You just have to do this testing and this protocol. Most of the people that I work with, they've already done protocol after protocol after protocol. They've done all the testing. They're still not getting better. And so that's always my first question is I'm like, hold up the mirror of self-reflection. Why do you think you're not getting better? And I just listen. And some of the stuff that I hear is pretty nuts. So then it's like, we have to, okay, what can you do? What do you have control of? How can you improve your circumstances? And I think there's so much that people are kind of bypassing. And I think a lot of times they're kind of being led down these rabbit holes and they're losing themselves in that and losing a lot of money in that too.
Yeah, you know, we'll definitely talk about the rabbit holes in a second, but I wanted to highlight some things that you said that I thought were really important. It sounds like your approach really puts them back in the driver's seat, and they're now cause over their health, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas typically they come to you, they're at an effect on their health, right? Mm-hmm. Something outside of their control and their viewpoint is causing this illness, right? And there definitely can be environmental factors causing or exacerbating chronic inflammation, as you mentioned, one of the foundations of chronic illness. But the reality remains there's something they can do about it. And mm-hmm. by helping them shift from effect back to cause, and they start taking these successful actions towards better health, you're able to help them. So there is definitely, it sounds like a very big coaching element to what you do. And you know, again, they have to be willing to rip that Band-Aid off to work with you because they're going to have to really face these realities.
Yeah, it was really perceptive and well said because I'm like, I don't even know what I just said. But It reminds me of what I was just talking to Dr. Tina on her podcast, and that subject came up of, I think it's important for the audience to be aware of there's passive care and active care, right? Passive care is that's not under your control. That's what somebody does to you, right? Like a doctor administers XYZ pharmaceuticals or therapies, right? They are doing that to you. It's passive. You know, it's like, you don't have to move. You don't have to do anything. They do it to you. Active care is you're doing it, right? Like exercise, that's active care. Changing your nutrition, that's active care. Stress management, that's active care. Sleep hygiene, hydration, you know, moving out of that environment. Like that's the stuff that you have control of, which I would say is the majority of the equation. And, you know, part of that, you know, I'm not a licensed medical provider. I can't prescribe drugs. If I could, I would, and maybe I would do more passive care, but because I can't and I don't, I have to make the most out of the active care, which is, and I can't do that. Like I can't change their diet for them. I can't start exercising for them, but I can coach them through it. I can teach them how to do it. I can empower and educate them and hold space for when they just need to be human and let out some steam, right? So, but I think that's the thing, is there's too much emphasis on the protocol in the passive care, and a lot of people maybe are not taking ownership of all the things that they have control of with the active care that they can do for themselves. And it's like they want that. And this is why America is in the health crisis they are, is, you know, a lot of people don't want to change their diet and lifestyle. They don't want to start exercising. They don't want to give up the gluten, even though it's causing massive inflammation in their body. It's like, Can't you just give me a pill that makes it all better? And it's like, yeah, but that's kind of the problem going on with Big Pharma right now. And, you know, they're making a lot of money doing it. So,
right. And we all know that Big Pharma, I mean, any drug on the marketplace, you take it to suppress your symptoms. You know, you don't, yeah. It's not going to fix the root cause of what's causing the symptoms in the first place. Symptoms are an alarm. It's our body telling us that there's a problem and something needs to change. Yep. You know, and so suppressing that and continuing on is probably not the best course of action. Right. You know, we know we don't have Advil deficiencies when we have a headache. We have something that's causing us to have a headache, right? And so it's being in touch with your body and taking action to correct that. Let's talk about some of the rabbit holes for a minute, and let's talk about HLA-DR and all that stuff, because I'm highly fascinated on your take. You know, I've heard in the past 10 years about the HLA-DR. It affects 25% of the population, doesn't allow them to methylate. As well as someone who doesn't have that gene or isn't a carrier of that gene. I know you mentioned it and you talked about the Kool-Aid. So would love to hear, you know, kind of some of the horror stories about it that you've heard people come and talk. And let's talk about the limitations of how that thinking that you have a specific gene might impact your ability to recover, because you kind of, I would imagine, lose hope that there is something for you to do.
Yeah, it's a big Pandora's box. And, you know, I've kind of built a reputation in this industry because everybody says I'm just, you know, kind of no BS. And it's like, well, somebody has to say it, because we're just enabling silly behavior, right? Where we enable people to believe that they're more helpless than we are. And it's like, so we're disempowering people with what is highly theoretical science, like highly theoretical. So it's kind of one of those, like with the genetic side, look, do I think genetics is the future of medicine? Yeah, absolutely. It's the future of bioindividualized medicine. There's a lot of really cool research being done in genetics. I'm pretty well plugged in, and, you know, the stuff with CRISPR and gene editing, and we're going to have designer babies within the next 50 years. Like, yes. But the problem with the genetic craze, because it sounds cool, right? Ooh, epigenetics, and this gene explains why I'm incapable of reaching my life goals. And here's kind of the issue I see, is people use genes or these little, you know, cliff note sound bites that is like semi-valid science taken out of context and portrayed in a way of like, this is the end all be all and this is the problem. So like, everybody in the mold space has heard, like, yeah, HLA, 25% makes it harder to detox mycotoxins, or, you know, MTHFAR, now you can't methylate, now you can't produce glutathione. It'd be similar to saying like, oh, you have ApoE, therefore you're going to die of Alzheimer's in 30 years. And it's like, but that's not true, right? I'm not saying that, yes, you know, there is some validity. Like there's over 25,000 genes in the human body. There's how many SNPs per 25,000 genes? And we don't even know that much about these SNPs. There's only really a handful that we've identified as like, we have enough research about MTHFR 1298 and 677 to know like those two SNPs out of what there's like at least 20 other MTHFR SNPs that we know like nothing about. And then it's like, but what about the expression of the gene? Because the body has a lot of compensatory pathways and mechanisms. You know, maybe you're weak in this pathway, but this other pathway is super strong and it makes up for that, right? So it's such a nuanced conversation, and I can't stand when I see this stuff portrayed out of context, because then it just causes disempowerment and fear. Like, oh no, I have the HLA, there's no hope for me. You know, if that's what they're receiving, we're doing it wrong. We're portraying the information wrong. You know, what we need to be empowering them of like, okay, well, regardless of your genes, because we all hear too, like, you know, genes load the gun, but environment, lifestyle pull the trigger, right? So why don't we focus on what we can control with your environment, your lifestyle? And, you know, obviously our genes do make us unique. You know, we're like 99.9% genetically identical, but that 0.0001%, you know, it's why you and I don't look exactly the same, or everybody else has their unique characteristics. But we can't get hung up on that, and we can't victimize ourselves based on theoretical science.
I really appreciate that. And I think that it helps provide clarity for someone who may have been told that they have this genetic expression that's going to create challenges for them. And, you know, maybe it does create a little bit of a challenge, right? But the fact remains is that you could still do something about it.
Right.
And so I love that you don't get hung up on that, and you still empower people to do something irregardless of whatever difficulties they may be having. And they have to be willing to change, you know, and I think that's really important. But, you know, the fact that you can do something about it, I think it does give hope back.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the protocols. You know, sure. You've obviously heard probably horror stories too, where people have gone from doctor to doctor to doctor to doctor and tried every protocol under the sun, and everybody's got their own protocol and their own kick, and it's all marketing hoopla and all that kind of stuff. Right. But at the end of the day, is there any validity out there to using binders and some of these products? What can they help with? And, you know, I know that you don't sell these products, but you said that earlier, if you could, you probably would sell some. So what, you know, map that out for us. You know, what is the most important thing? And then why should you care about any of these supplements, if any at all?
Yeah. Well, I do want to be transparent. I do sell a lot of supplements, and I'm huge. So here's the thing, because I never want people to think like I'm being hypocritical. It's funny because like I've really built my career on being a lab analysis wizard, like teaching practitioners lab analysis is what I do for a living, and, you know, building good protocols off the labs. Like that's actually like my business model, but my background is more psychological, lifestyle, exercise, nutrition-based coaching. So my biggest critique of functional medicine as an industry is there's way too much fixation on labs and protocols and not enough emphasis on the lifestyle and the psychology and the, like, I look around the functional medicine space, which I'm very well established, very well connected, mostly respected. I'm sure some people have an issue with me. But I look at the industry, I'm like, you know what? 90% of all the stuff that we're doing in this industry could be fixed by nutrition, exercise, stress management, sleep hygiene, the basics. And so it just kills me when I see so many people, they get chewed up and spit out by conventional, they dip their toes into functional, but then they get chewed up and spit out and confused and disempowered through kind of the stuff that we're talking about. But with all of that said, why I'm so passionate about labs and protocols, though, when done well, like that's the big thing, like when done well, which is an art and a science in itself, like a lab test, it's just data. And that data could be very educational, informative, empowering, and positive, or it could be very like fear inducing and disempowering. And it's not even as much about the data as it is, how does the practitioner interpret and explain the data, right? Like your genes are what they are, or, you know, the mycotoxin testing, right? Oh my gosh, I peed out a little bit of ochre toxin. I have SIRS. And it's like, whoever told you that sucks at lab interpretation, right? So there is kind of that side of it. And that's why, like, I created my own lab test that I'm, you know, pushing out there. Cause I'm like, what you guys are doing is silly. You can't say that just because you have a few mycotoxins in your urine that they have mold illness. We don't know anything about their physiology. Right. You know, you got to do blood work to actually like, do you have inflammation? Do you have liver stress? Do you have kidney issues? Do you have you know, whatever it is, like the blood work is what qualifies that in conjunction with the symptomology. But, you know, I'm huge on designing a very well constructed protocol because, you know, number one, our society is heavily domesticated and programmed to reach for a pill for the ill, right? And that's fine. I don't have anything against pharmaceuticals or supplements. And ultimately it's like, that's what they want. So I will give them that. But also number two, popping some pills, that's the easiest thing you can do, right? Like dismantling self-limiting beliefs, facing early life stress or trauma, changing your diet, getting fit, working on your sleep hygiene, managing stress, moving out of a home. Those are big tasks, right? Like we can only handle so much, but that's why I'm so passionate about the supplement protocol is like, if I can at least get you on some good supplements and maybe we work with your doctor to get a couple drugs in there if needed, it can immediately start moving the direction, right? Because the needle, and if we can get them feeling a little bit better, they're going to be more capable to then take on some of those bigger tasks of changing the lifestyle, changing the diet, so on and so forth. So I am big on like, if we can get you on a good protocol and, you know, the binders and whatever, absolutely. I mean, I've got my go-to for every mold case. I'm huge on binders like charcoal and bentonite and zeolite and fiber and apple pectin, humic fulvic acid, immunoglobulins, probiotics, different nutraceuticals, antioxidants. I mean, I definitely have a repertoire of supplements I use with everybody for mold, and it works really, really well. And it's the easiest thing they can do, but it can go overboard too.
So to clarify your point from earlier, basically you're more, it's not that you're against supplements or protocols, you're against one size fits all. Mm-hmm. You want to actually have individualized data and help put together programs based upon what's going to be most effective for that person, which is really amazing, you know? And like you said, it takes someone skilled that understands how to interpret the data and really utilize it correctly. It happens to me on the environmental side, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody is happy going to collect data, you know, and data is great, but how do you utilize that data? You know, there's a big push on actinomycetes right now. Dr. Mm-hmm. Shoemaker says it's never been mold. It's actinomycetes. Yeah, I was wrong.
I keep hearing that.
Which is interesting. But and then he develops a test with Envirobiomics to do actinomycetes testing. Yep. But here's where we are with actinomycetes. It would be like if you went to your home and did an ERMI without identifying where the sources are. And so now you're looking at this score and you're like, oh my God, I have a problem. But where's that problem coming from? Actinomycetes sheds from humans. It's in the soil. It could be in your drain lines. It could be in water damaged buildings, right? So there's all these different things. And so now we have this storm of people that are like, well, I need to only be concerned about the actinomycetes. I don't want to do any mold remediation. I want to do it with actinomycetes. And where we are technology-wise, we're at the infancy of understanding what actinomycetes is and how it impacts your home and what even the test validates, right? So we can't utilize the technology. So it's a little bit premature to go out there and start scaring people and saying, this is what's impacting your health, really, because I think it's a composite of everything that you have in your environment, right? Your VOCs, mold, bacteria, endotoxins, mycotoxins. You want to try to limit everything, but you know, right. Kind of ties into what you were saying, where like we have this lab data now that people are interpreting and they're saying that it's bad. but there's no solution for it yet, right? So we're just riling people up and scaring them and telling them there's nothing they can do, which is not really the right way. And by the way, I've been remediating homes and helping people get better for 10 years before we were testing for actinomycetes. So I think if you're able to limit, you know, 80, 75 to 80% of what's going on in your environment, you're going to create a healthier space. And, you know, start doing all these other things like exercising, eating better, taking the right supplements that your body needs, not just broad ones that are supposedly helping everybody. Right. And, and being very individualized. I love the way this conversation kind of headed and organically. And you are a guy that's no BS, you know, you're very blunt and direct and, you know, like you said earlier, that may rub some people the wrong way and that's okay. You know, even myself, sometimes I guess I rub people the wrong way. Unfortunately, can't please everybody, but the reality of it is like people need to hear this information. They need to know that there is something they can do about it, not to be fearful of all this stuff. Just do what you can. And things that you can do is change your diet, exercise, get out of the environment, or you know, make some improvements towards improving that environment. These are all actionable steps you can take. So I really appreciate your insight on that.
No, I really appreciate this conversation. We're getting into the good stuff, right? Because there's too many conversations, even just in the mold space, too many people, too many conversations that's just further pulling people down the rabbit hole, which is self-interested from a monetary perspective. And what you just described is exactly what that's my biggest critique against this industry. And I'm not going to enable it. I'm not going to play into that. I'm happy to be the guy that speaks out to pop those. And look, you know, I'm not saying that there might not be something to it. Sure, some researcher, you know, if Shoemaker wants to spend the rest of his career researching and trying to, cool, like somebody probably should look into that. But this is where, like, with my practitioner students, when I'm training them and mentoring them on how to be good practitioners, I make a big point. We have to be able to distinguish between clinical theory and what's clinically applicable, right? Because like there's no room for theory when you're trying to help a desperate person improve their health. There's no room for theory. We can't bring our theory into it, right? We have to stay grounded in like, well, what actually works and what can we do? And are we moving the needle? And we have to be objective about it, right? So, you know, that's such a huge part of the problem in the bioindividualization. So I think if people are pulling you down these theoretical rabbit holes rather than empowering you with like, hey, we're not entirely sure about this, but here's all the stuff that we do know. It's tried, it's true. Here's what we can focus on to help you right here, right now. So it's just kind of what the focus is. But
let's talk a little bit about the test that you're coming out with. I'm excited to hear about it. I know we talked about it on the Instagram live we did together a couple of weeks ago. You know, can you explain a little bit about the test, why you believe that this test is better than some of the other products already out there, and what people can expect if they utilize your testing packaging?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to. And I, again, you know, not trying to be a hypocrite, because like, cool, like do the, you know, actinomyces test and whatever. But so my whole thing, the way that this started is when I was working with mold clients and really like the mold brain thing, and I saw a lot of repeating elements and patterns, like, for example, random, and this isn't even really super related to my test. I mean, kind of. But like, for example, I see over and over a lot of the people that do have mold illness, they also have an undetected, undiagnosed celiac response, right? I never overlook the gluten thing. I hate the subject, but I'm very gluten-free. I'm on the celiac spectrum. It's one of those things that if somebody's struggling with, you know, their health, their mental health, their gut health, their skin health, whatever it is, and they've never considered that maybe gluten is a driving force in that, like everybody should do celiac testing. And I'm not necessarily gluten sensitivity. We don't need to go off into a tangent. But my whole thing with working with all these mold clients, we have to make the dollar go as far as possible, because these people, they might have to sell their homes. They might have to buy a new home. They might have to break a lease. They might have to sell a lot of stuff they own or get rid of it and buy new stuff. And then the lab testing, the service fees, the 50 supplements that all the doctors are recommending, it's such a ridiculously like cost inefficient process. And the number one thing that I see people struggling with is like, they can't afford the help that they need. And like, that was me and my fiance. We were going to work with that naturopathic doctor, but we couldn't afford it. We didn't have the money to pay for out of pocket, you know, naturopathic healthcare. So, and then there's so much trial and error. And it bothers me when I see like functional providers testing their theories and kind of using their clients or patients as guinea pigs to fund their research. And like, that's not doing right by people, right? So I was doing custom blood work on all my, which I think is very valuable. Mycotoxin testing, I don't think it's super like, it's not super valuable, but it can be helpful. Some people need to see that to, you know, believe it or whatever. But my whole point that I want to make very clear is like, whether it's, you know, you do a sinus swab or a stool test or a toxin excretion test, or, you know, measuring all of these things in all of these mediums, but what's the physiology doing? If we don't do blood work, we don't know what's going on with their physiological function. How are their organs functioning? How is their body functioning, right? Because ultimately, why do we care about mycotoxins coming out in the urine? Well, if they're coming out in the urine, they went through the body. And if they're going through the body, are they damaging the body? And how does that hurt the body? Well, it hurts the liver, the kidneys, it can drive oxidative stress and inflammation. So the question is, but do you have any objective evidence that you have oxidative stress, that you have inflammation, that you have liver stress, that you have kidney? So you can see that in the blood work. And so I was doing this custom blood panel on all of my clients and seeing all these common patterns. I was like, you know what? I need to like put this together as a proprietary panel. I need to brand it. I need to train providers on how to use it. I need to get it in the hands of more consumers, because what I see over and over is I get all these people that identify as having mold illness, and they've been convinced that they have mold illness and MCAS and all these things, but they don't have the data to validate that. They don't have the data to prove that they are as ill as they've been led to believe by the people that they were paying. And it's a lot of that self-interested stuff. So then when I run my test that actually very objectively, a lot of very well-researched biomarkers of inflammation, oxidative stress, immune activation, all these things, then I can see like, yes or no, like, yes, your liver is actually very stressed, or yes, you do have high levels of inflammation. But if we don't assess that, we're kind of just making stuff up and we don't actually know. And the biggest problem, how do you assess progress when healing from mold or anything else? Like, urinary toxin excretion is a horrible way to measure progress. You're going to have different levels of toxins coming out in your urine every time you pee in a cup. And it doesn't tell us, is your body healing? Because we don't have physiological data. It's kind of like, if your goal is to lose 100 pounds, how do you measure progress? Well, I'll just weigh myself every day on the scale. Okay, so then if the scale isn't constantly going down, you're going to freak out and feel like you're not making progress. So like, that's what got me into lab testing. I was like, okay, we're not going to use the scale. We're going to use blood work, because, you know, your glucose, your triglycerides, your cholesterol, your liver enzymes, that's going to get better before the scale reflects progress. It's much more sensitive. So part of the whole point of my test called the mental map is now we have clinically researched, valid, sensitive, objective data that shows us where are you at, like how inflamed, how stressed out is your body. But now we can track progress, like are the markers moving in the right direction? They're very, very sensitive. So if the program, the protocol, whatever you're doing, if it's working, we should see that data getting better and better. And if it's moving in the wrong direction, we got to change things, right? So yeah. That was kind of my whole point. The whole point of the test, it was all developed around mold brain. And it's primarily focused on neuroinflammation is kind of the primary thing it's designed to be assessing.
Well, that's awesome. Well, thank you for doing all that work to put that together. I know that's going to help a lot of people get the clinical data they really need to understand, right? As you mentioned earlier, you know, Mike, understanding if you're urinating mycotoxins, you know, which could potentially be coming from your environment, maybe that's helpful to identify if there's something going on in your environment that you want to correct. But like you said, it makes sense. It's not very helpful in terms of how is it impacting the rest of your body, and what can you do to support that, right? So I think that's great that you were able to kind of put that together, and you're training other physicians as well to administer these types of tests. So you could really start to build that platform to help people. I would imagine it's going to be helpful in various case studies as well, having some of that data to understand, like, okay, well, if we have the data in the home. And one of the things that I'm putting together is a nonprofit called Change the Air Foundation. And I think it's 25% of the funds are going to go towards research. We want to bridge the gap between the clinical studies and the environmental studies, right? Because there's no correlation.
Right.
That's the problem. You know, people are getting sick from mold exposure, and they're trying to use the mycotoxin urine analysis to say, you know, definitively that, yes, they're exposed to mycotoxins. That's why they're sick. And of course, on the other side of things, they're saying, well, they could have got the mycotoxins from food and other things, right? So it may not necessarily be the home. But if we can actually prove that the home has mycotoxins environmentally that match what's going on inside the body, then you can say, well, it makes sense. That's what they're exposed to, right? And then when you tie that into other biomarkers, then you can say, not only is that happening, but it's also causing their biomarkers to change that's making them sick. So that's how you can tie that together, which is great. So we'll have to talk offline about utilizing your testing technology and get you in on this. But we're pretty excited about the research studies, because so much of the research studies out there are not connecting the dots the way they need to be connected. And it's really got to be both an environmental and a clinical study mixed together, which is really going to get us the data so we need to understand how these things impact the person. And of course, we have to put in there, you know, what's their lifestyle? What's their diet? What's the impact that has as well, right, on their susceptibility?
Yeah, so we'll definitely have to talk more behind the scenes, because I just set up my not-for-profit research foundation. And
awesome.
You know, similar long-term goals with that, but even just within this past month, I did a case study that's exactly what you just described, where it's a client that I've been working with for over a year. I referenced her earlier, actually. And I did mold testing and everything from day one, but a lot of her mold specific testing was negative. And so we kind of like put it off the radar. And then, you know, we've had kind of this up and down progress over the course of a year. And there was starting to be some stuff popping up that kind of told me, like, I think we need to revisit the mold thing, right? So then I did kind of a rebatch of testing. And then this time, you know, we did the mental map, organic acids, fungal antibodies, mycotoxin testing. We did all of it. And this time mold was screaming on the lab results. So then we did an ERMI in her environment, and her ERMI's like, not the, you know, how the ERMI score sucks.
Yeah,
The ERMI data was pretty awful. So now we have that as a case study of, here's her environment, here's her blood work and physiological biomarkers, here's the oat test, here's the mycotoxin. And it's a beautiful case study. Probably the most comprehensive to what we're talking about here.
Awesome. Well, so glad that you are also starting a nonprofit and doing research. One of the other things that we plan to do is policy reform. You know, mold is not considered a health hazard in any state in America, which is sickening, because it is a health hazard, right? It's certainly not good for you to have high levels and concentrations of mold in your home, or the EPA wouldn't recommend removing it, right? It would be this no big deal thing. And although there is that mentality in many, many different people's minds, the government knows that it's not great, and it does recommend removing it, and does, you know, talk about water damaged buildings and how they can impact the health. But yet the state departments do not have them listed as a health hazard. So these are some of the things that need to change. Insurance companies get away with not fixing things properly. They make it look like it never happened, but scientifically it's the data still points that there was a problem there, and it's still all over the home. So these are some of the things we want to change. We'll have to collab together on some research studies, and would love to work with you on that. I really appreciate your time here today. Can I get a recommendation from you regarding what's the one thing you know, if you had to tell somebody, knowing all that you know in regards to dealing with mold exposure, dealing with chronic illness, you know, what's the one suggestion you can make? And if it could only be one thing, what would it be?
I get questions like that a lot, and it's always hard. It's always really hard. You know, there's like so many aspects to that, because you have to do everything. But I think the number one thing is getting the mindset in a place like where you're accepting responsibility for the position you're in, right? Where I think all too often, you know, and this kind of is what leads people down the functional medicine rabbit holes, is they want to find something to attach to that makes them feel like it's not my fault. And it's, you know, this is something that kind of victimizing themselves a little bit.
Right.
And here's the thing. It doesn't matter if we're talking about, you know, mold illness or anything else. At the end of the day, we have this choice of like, you can choose to be a victim or you can choose to be a victor. And it's one or the other. There's no in the middle there. You either victimize yourself and victim mentality, which keeps you stuck forever, or you rise above, right? And here's the thing, like that might sound pompous because it's like, well, easy for you to say, I'm bedridden and chronic illness over here. And it's like, man, but you know, for example, you look at oncology, there's a really well-respected naturopathic physician, and I was at his conference a few years ago, and it was all oncology. But here's the thing, you look at cancer patients, the ones that practice resilience and they fight for their life, they always have better clinical outcomes. That doesn't mean that they always survive. They'll go down fighting sometimes, but still, you look at the survival rate and clinical outcomes, the ones that fight and practice resilience, they have better clinical outcomes. Whereas the ones that, you know, woe is me victim mentality, they go pretty fast. And that sentiment is just true across the board. So that's kind of the thing I would, you know, throw out there is like victim or victor. It's your choice. Which do you want to be?
I'd rather go down fighting. Yeah. And I think that highlights how important the state of mind really is for a person, right? You know, and the people that try to find positivity in everything they do, they live healthier, happier lives, you know? And I think that's important to say the power of the mind, I think is much stronger than we can even comprehend, you know? And I've seen a lot of people, and that's why they meditate and they try to get the mind right. And they try to, you know, wrap their head around struggles and how can I, you know, take this tragedy and empower myself to go a step further. So I think it's really important to highlight that, you know, the power of the mind, you see it in clinical studies, like the people that don't give up, that don't lose hope. Yeah. Those are the people that make it through these tough times, you know? And so if you're listening and you feel, you know, like nothing's going your way, you know, don't give up hope, you know, and try to turn this around and celebrate the little wins, you know, the day that you were able to get out of bed and do something, celebrate that instead of focusing on, you know, the difficult times, because unfortunately that when you focus too much on the difficult times and you worry too much, it can consume you, you know, and can put you in that victim state of mind where, you know, you won't get better. Right. And so I think that was really powerful. Brendan, thank you so much for being on today. It was a pleasure having you. I can't wait for people to hear this and, you know, form whatever opinion they may have of this topic of discussion today. I think it was a very interesting approach and perspective that we brought here. There's a lot of good things that you're doing. Love the mental map. Where can people find you to work with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Michael, this has been such a pleasure. It's great to connect with you. And I'm sure that this is just the beginning of a long friendship and we can collaborate and all the things.
Definitely.
So, you know, people can find me on Instagram. It's at the Holistic Savage. That's my main platform where I put everything out. And then of course the website, metabolicsolutionsllc.com. That's anything business related, but I really appreciate the opportunity. Like I live for these kinds of conversations. I think we need more of this kind of dialogue to get out there, because I think this is very educational and empowering, not, you know, fear inducing and disempowering like a lot of the other stuff.
Yeah, look, and it was an honest conversation. It was blunt. It was direct. You know, and I think it gives people a different perspective than what they're used to hearing. Because, like you said, yeah, a lot of people are selling people one size fits all. Even in remediation, you know, people are peddling that you got to do everything, or you're never going to get better. And right, really, you know, health is about taking the right steps. So, you know, if you look at scientifically what is creating the most impact, and you start there, you can't afford to do everything else. I think that's a wise move. Do something, right? Take control over something. Do what's in your control, as we kind of talked about the theme of this. So thank you very much for your time today, and looking forward to this.
Thank you, Michael.